Group meeting, Sunday, 14th March, 1982. Those of you who were here last month may remember that our meetings were the 20th anniversary meetings since these groups started. And we had a very short history, so to say, of the 20 years. You may remember I said we have held 1,038 meetings in this room during those 20 years. This is just the group meetings. Doesn't count the number of meetings we held here when we had some summer schools here in this house. And then we considered very briefly the sort of spirit that animates our activity here. We ended up with a consideration of by taking stock of ourselves, so to say. And I put that in the form of several questions, very briefly. And the first question was, are we, as a result of our 20 years' work, somewhat quieter? One couldn't say perfectly quiet, because that would mean that we were as good as any of the great founders of the religions. But somewhat quieter. And I thought it might be useful today to consider this question of quietness and the silence as carefully as we can, because it is of the utmost importance where the religious life is concerned. The purpose of the religious life is to enable that transformation of our mode of awareness of existence to come to fruition. We are conscious in ordinary worldly terms as we are. And those worldly terms are not terms of true human fulfillment. We are aware of conflict, of struggle, of self-centeredness, self-orientedness, and in addition to physical illnesses, there are psychical illnesses as such. Now, being conscious as we are, in the manner in which we are conscious, all those difficulties and problems are bound to exist. If there is that mode of living, we may call it a discipline if we like, if there is that kind of discipline which can bring about a complete transmutation of our mode of awareness of existence, and therefore of what we ourselves are and our relationship to mankind and to the whole world, then the purpose of our existence in spiritual terms is fulfilled, completely fulfilled. And if it is completely fulfilled in spiritual terms, it also means that it is fulfilled in all those terms which mark the true human. You may recall I have said times out of number that we are still at the subhuman stage. I'm not using the word subhuman in an insulting or pejorative manner, but merely stating a fact, because we are still developing, we are still growing towards becoming full-fledged humans. And you'll recall that the true meaning of the word human is blissful creator. The happy, the prefix hu, just like the prefix su in Pali, if su is more used more in Sanskrit, hu, you see. The prefix hu means happy. He who has arrived happily at the fulfillment. That's what that prefix means. And the rest of the word man, derived from the Sanskrit man, means in the ordinary way to think. It means to think, but not thinking in our sense of thinking, but thinking in the transcendent sense. Thought, if it is a true expression of pure mind, is a creative power. In the theistic religions, we are taught that the universe is created through the thought in the mind of God. Now, what does that mean? Unless we are deeply versed in all this, we naturally project our own mode of thinking and our own concept of what mind is onto God, which is completely absurd. Because the context of the divine is the transcendent context. It's the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. Our context, our worldly context, is the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. So, the thought in the mind of God is something entirely different from the thought in my mind or in the mind of any subhuman. But when the subhuman has come to his fulfillment, his fruition, and is the true human, then mind for the first time really begins to function through him. And it functions entirely creatively. Creatively, again, not in our ordinary meaning of the word. We talk of an artist, a philosopher, a poet, and so forth, as a creative person. He is a procreative person. We, at our subhuman stage, are procreative biologically and culturally. So the cultural part of our life is what we call creativeness. Now that is not true creativeness. True creativeness, of course, is exemplified in statements in the scriptures. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Well, I can never say, "Let there be this, that, or the other," and there will be this, that, or the other. It just isn't so, you see. Now, there are very profound meanings to this, which our intellects can only dimly perceive. We can sense these things in a shadowy way, provided we become quiet. And in some degree or other, have a touch of the experience of the real silence. I will come to that in a few moments. Quietness as such in our ordinary everyday life is something which conduces to greater sensitivity. Sensitivity to the world around us. A sensitivity which is a sympathetic sensitivity. We are more in harmony with whatever is around us, whether it be pleasant or unpleasant, whether it be beneficial or harmful or hurtful. Also, quietness implies that we can have a clearer perception of the truth of things and of persons. Also, it makes for less and less psychical turmoil. And if there is less psychical turmoil, then what we commonly call peace of mind begins to manifest in our own lives. When peace of mind comes to full expression in our lives, then mind for the first time functions fully and freely in us, and it is associated with peace in the same sense as we talk of the peace of God which passes understanding. And that state is a completely silent state. The silent state, of course, is experienced, is realized in degrees. There are grades and grades of realizing this silence. It is as if the door was shut by consciousness upon that which was the lesser state. Say, well, let us put it like this. The sub-sub-human state, the really bestial state. All right. When a certain degree of peace and quiet really permeates the psychophysical organism, and we may emerge into the ordinarily subhuman state, then we have shut the door upon the sub-subhuman state. We can also say we have destroyed that state. Now, the word destruction has been used by very great teachers. The Buddha was one. He used the word destruction. And Krishnamurti in our own day has used the word destruction very significantly. But I think it is not easy to understand in what sense. For us, destruction generally means annihilation. There is, of course, destruction which in a sense is annihilation. If you take a piece of paper and burn it, or shall we say, if you slay something which is alive, you destroy it. All right, you have deprived it of life. You can bury it, you can burn it afterwards, you do what you please, and you destroy it. And we naturally regard that as annihilating that which has been killed, you see. The idea of annihilation is bound up with the idea of death and destruction for most of us. But now, destruction has another aspect to it. Destruction, in all likelihood, is involved in the process of transmutation. See what happens in the case of the transmutation of a chemical element. The properties of a chemical element depend upon the number of electrons that are in any atom of that element. That determines the chemical properties. And the number of atoms electrons is equal to the number of protons in the nucleus of that element. Now, when you get the bombardment of the nucleus by various means that we have at our disposal, you can produce a totally new element. For example, when the hydrogen nuclei combine, they will give you helium, you see. Now, both the nucleus as well as the number of electrons around the nucleus of the helium atom are different from the two hydrogen nuclei which were involved in producing this. So we may say that we have destroyed those hydrogen nuclei as such, but we have released a helium nucleus. You get the idea? In the same way, the destruction of what is commonly described as the destruction of evil in our own psyche. When the Buddha talked, for instance, of the destruction of the mental defilements, as he called them, you see. The destruction of the mental defilements really means the transmutation of that which has manifested as evil into that which is now a power for good. So you see, this is what happens really in the process of that destruction. So that destruction implies shutting the door on the less, on the lesser state, on the imperfect state, the ill state or the evil state. It is like shutting the door on it. It's done with forever, and you are in a profounder, freer, and more fulfilled state. Is that reasonably clear? Good. All right. So now, let us consider the actual silence as such. Now, what becomes silent in us? It is the cessation of the flow of discursive thought in our ordinary as we are at present. The cessation of the flow of discursive thought. Consider what we mean by saying, I think. I am talking inaudibly. That is what my thinking means. If I go through a process of thought, as I say, I am saying so many things quietly. And the expression of that openly is audible speech. Speech, the spoken word is audible, the thought is inaudible speech. That's all it is. You'll find this stated quite openly by one of the Buddha's foremost nuns when her ex-husband comes visiting her and asks questions about the holy life and so forth. And she gives the analysis of the teachings. And she says quite openly, discursive thought belongs to the category of speech. Now this is very significant. Now, consider what this speech which goes on in our minds constantly, goes on in our brains. What is it about? It is almost entirely self-centered, self-oriented speech. It is speech which expresses inaudibly our own conflicts, our own problems, our confusions, our struggles, and so forth. Now, this speech is the great disturber in our lives. The psyche is in a state of turmoil with all this speech. And our everyday life is a life which in its actions will inevitably express this turmoil, this conflict, and so forth. Now, in order to heal us of this flow of inaudible speech, this flow of discursive thought, various techniques have been laid down. Those techniques could help up to a point, but no more. But people have great confidence in these techniques because there is the authority of the teacher, the guru, and so forth with regard to this. But consider carefully just precisely what form these techniques take. The form taken is a verbal ritual. You see, this is one of the one of the important things which we fail to see. We believe that if we go through this verbal ritual, just as in a church and with any sort of congregational worship, you go through a verbal ritual. And that verbal ritual may, of course, be accompanied by deep feeling. Deep feeling. But what does it do actually to the psyche? It produces a state of elevation, of exaltation. Sometimes, if it is intense enough and of the right sort, you can have insight suddenly open up. You can have the lightning flash of something transcendent touch you. You may do that. But generally speaking, it is just a set of words. Come out of the church and see, as you're waiting for your bus or getting into your car or something, just observe what you're thinking of then and the thought process. Are you permanently changed into something which is rich and strange, which is nearer the transcendent? You find you are not. You will find, generally speaking, you will find nothing has happened. Momentarily, there has been an effect. So, these laid down techniques are somewhat like drugs. They are like dope. They are like counteractions. But counteracting always means conflict. And if you take something which anesthetizes your sensitivities, it diminishes the healthiness of the whole psychophysical organism. So that has to be remembered. All the same, it is quite useful to practice laid down techniques. I did them myself for over 60 years, right from my young days as a child, almost for 60 years. This is how I discovered some of these things which I tell you. Then I realized just what happens, you see. You are really diminished rather than growing towards your fulfillment. But practice them, because unless you actually practice some of them, you won't discover their uselessness. Now, you see, this applies with regard to many aspects of our life, many aspects, not to all. Don't try to test the power of gravity by stepping over Beachy Head. Don't do it, because you'll never test anything again ever afterwards, for all eternity. You see? So there are certain things. Again, at a more ordinary level, don't test the effect of vodka. If you take 2 bottles or 10 bottles of it every day to find out whether it will, you'll get cirrhosis of the liver or not. Don't do it. This is a thing from real life. There was an elderly gentleman who, with age, had begun to suffer from little rheumatism and so forth, and he used to go to his doctor, and one day when he was in some pain, he said, "Doctor, you know, when I do this," and the doctor immediately said, "Don't do it, you damn fool," straight away, just like that. So don't do it. There are certain things like that, but otherwise experiment and you'll find out for yourself what it is like. But there is a way, there may be ways by which one can sensibly emerge into the silence, instead of trying to force yourself into it. All these techniques by taking drugs and so on in order to obtain trips in higher realms and so forth are really evil things. If you know what happens when a storm breaks out, you're inside, supposing you're at home inside the house, well, you just You just stay in and watch. And you see, every storm will ultimately settle down. It will come to its end. Now, it's the same with storms in our psyche. If you simply sit quietly and watch it, you will see that it will settle down. But there is a difference compared with the analogy of the external storm in nature. If one watches the storm in one's own psyche taking place, then you begin to understand all the forces at play which are responsible for that storm. And in understanding those forces at play, understanding, those forces become transformed, become transmuted. If your watchfulness is really very intense and powerful, they become transmuted into powers for good. All vices can be transmuted into active virtues. So that is what happens. And you will find that the inward poise and peace which you experience will grow and grow until there comes the point when the whole flow of discursive thought becomes completely still. It becomes completely still, but your senses are still functioning. They are functioning much more actively, much more intensely. And your awareness of the reality which is around you is of a totally different nature from your awareness in the ordinary state. In fact, it is a transcendent perception which grows inside you, in that silent state. Now, what is the significance of this? What do words represent? Now, come back to our ordinary thinking process. What do words represent? All our words, especially our nouns and verbs, they represent persons, things, relationships, and the activity which goes on between oneself and the persons and things, situations and events and so forth. This is what all our speech is about, what language is about. It confines us entirely to the world as it is, the world of becoming, the samsara. Becoming into being, the proceeding and the dying, the ending. So, in one's consciousness is tied up with this perpetual round, and it never ceases. You know how it's in the first book of, or the second book of Kings, Elijah and Elisha go walking together, and they first come to Gilgal. You know what Gilgal means? It means the round. And the sons of the prophets, it's always 50 sons of the prophets are there waiting, and they say to Elisha, "Do you know that the Lord will be taken away from your head now?" And Elisha says, "Yea, I know it," but he goes on with Elisha goes on with Elijah, and they reach the next stage, which is Bethel. Bethel means, the meaning of the name Bethel is the house of the Lord. So you see, when they have finished with the round, they have shut the door on the round, they come into the house of the Lord, into a much more developed state of consciousness. That's what it means. And again, 50 sons of the prophets are there. The Lord will be taken away from you now. Elisha, without saying it in my words, he says, "Shut up, I know all that. We'll get along." And they next come to Jericho. The meaning of Jericho is the place of fragrance. Fragrance. There is an extraordinary fragrance, something which is not just pleasure, delight, joy, happiness as we appreciate it, but something nor ecstasy as we appreciate, as we understand it, but it's a deep ecstasy where for the first time you experience the perfume of transcendence. And there too, the 50 sons of the prophets, and then they go on, you see, further on, leaving that stage also behind them. You see, the degrees of silence are becoming more and more intense. In a biblical narrative or any scriptural narrative, you'll get it told like a worldly journey, as in a worldly journey or story. But actually, you are just where you are, and the state of consciousness becomes more and more intense. This is how you go through the jhanas and the samapattis. The state of consciousness becomes much more intense every time. So after Jericho, the place of fragrance, now there is the impulse, the impulsion by transcendence itself to reach the final stage. And note again, four stages and four jhanas, four samapattis. It's rather interesting how you get these correspondences. The fourth condition is where they come to Jericho. And Jericho is the parting of the ways. I beg your pardon, not Jericho. They come to the last stage, the Jordan. We have passed Jericho. They come to the Jordan, which means the parting of the ways. Now, what is this parting of the ways? It is the final stage when all worldliness is finished with, destroyed, if you like, actually transmuted, so that you can realize the transcendent condition. And there, Elijah turns round and tells Elisha, "Before I'm taken up into the Lord, ask what you will." And Elisha asks for a double portion of grace for himself. And Elijah says, "It's a hard thing you have asked." Remember, the meaning of the word Elijah is God himself. And the meaning of the word Elisha is God the Savior. Most interesting. These aspects are all within us ourselves. Elijah, the supreme creative power which brings us into being. Elisha, that same transcendent power which enables us to go through our lesser stages and transform them into the stage which means one's complete fruition. So he says, "It's a hard thing you have asked of me." You know the Jewish tradition. The eldest son is given twice as much as each of the other sons. That's how they did it, you see. The sons of the prophet simply means the disciples of the teacher. That's what it means. If all the prophets had 50 sons, they'd have a great problem supporting the lot. However, there it is. So when they and Elijah says, "But it will be granted unto you if you see me when I'm taken up." And what happens when the chariot comes down, the chariot of fire? And relate that with Christ saying baptism by fire. And this sort of baptism by fire has many forms in various religions. "If you see me as I am taken up, then it will be unto you as you wish." You see? And when Elijah is taken up in that chariot, Elisha does see him and says, "Oh my father, the horsemen of Israel, the horsemen of Israel," and so on. And the mantle of Elijah falls on Elisha, which means that the imperfect human, the imperfect subhuman, has been completely transformed at last into the true human, the one who is the blissful creator. And being the blissful creator, he can salve, heal, which is the meaning of save others. This is the sort of thing that happens. But now, when it happens like that, what's happened? What's happened to our flow of discursive thought? It's come to a complete standstill. You're no longer thinking in subhuman terms. Your thinking has become this creative power which is at work all the time. That is why in the religious traditions of the world, the great teachers are said to be the immortal benefactors of the whole human race. You find it in all the traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Zarathustrian, Hebrew, Christian, I don't know about Islam, but all the other great religions have that tradition. So you see, this silence means just that transcendent condition. It means that your mode of awareness of existence, of the whole world in which you live, your relationship to it and so forth, has undergone the complete transmutation. The subhuman has been transmuted, destroyed, if you like to use that word, you see, and the divine has been completely released. Now, that has been expressed, for instance, in the Upanishads by the great teachers using the phrase Ahang Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. That's how they translate it. I would far prefer to put it this way. It is not, if you say I am Brahman, then it sounds frightfully conceited and almost blasphemous, doesn't it? But the point is this, that what is the separative, isolative I consciousness in us has been completely transformed into the infinite cosmic consciousness. So that when the perfected Holy One uses the word I, when he says Ahang, he means all humanity. He means, in fact, the one total reality. That is what he really means. And because this is so, you'll find this in all the religions, when somebody comes into his presence, that perfected Holy One knows that somebody inside out, straight away, because he is completely at one in innermost consciousness with him. So this is the great significance of the silence. The stoppage of the flow of discursive thought is just a preliminary stage, the very first touch of the silence and the very first touch of the perfume of transcendence entering into your life. And then as you go on, all that also ceases, that ecstasy into which you enter and realize this state of samadhi, that undergoes transformation too. So that ultimately it is transcendence itself which works, enters you freely and flows out of you into the world and affects the world as such. And it is transcendence which realizes its own transcendence in terms of man, the perfect man. Transcendence realizes its own transcendence and perfection and beauty and all the rest of it through all the different kingdoms that exist. through the perfect rose, through the perfect cloud, through the perfect storm, if you like, through the volcano and everything. It does its work and manifests itself in perfection in all those ways. But in man, it is different. Man does not manifest transcendence like that naturally and spontaneously. Man has developed, through man, the development of personal choice. Now don't throw choiceless awareness at me. That is in quite a different context. Man has this power of personal choice. He can rise to being a conscious cooperator with divinity, with the totality. When he really sees the truth, when he's really there, all selfness has completely been destroyed. And because all selfness has been completely destroyed, completely transmuted, then the pure, true human, which means the blissful creator, comes into activity. And it is transcendence which fulfills itself as man through him. The hint of this is really given in Genesis, the first chapter. An Elohim-minded, this is how I like to translate it, let us create man in our own living likeness. So I hope we will appreciate something. I've tried to suggest ways in which we can understand the tremendous significance of this silence.